Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Dr. Robert Hindren, professor and vice chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco, and moderator for your program this evening. It's now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Nora Volkov. Dr. Volkov is the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse of the National Institute of Health, where she has been an outstanding leader and researcher since 2003. It's no secret that addiction, whether to legal or illegal drugs, alcohol, sex, food, shopping, or a variety of other things, is a major problem in America, in addition to the rest of the world. Dr. Nora Volkov is a pioneer in working to treat and perhaps one day end addiction. Her studies of the brains of people addicted to drugs have helped to clarify the mechanisms of drug addiction. This research has helped to change the public's view of drug addiction from that of a moral violation or a character flaw to an understanding that the pathologic changes to the reward system of the brain make it very difficult for addicts to give up their addictions. We'll learn more about this evening. Dr. Volkov's research has also linked this dopamine reward system to understanding motivation and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, and also obesity and aging. Dr. Volkov has social activism in her genes. Her father and three sisters share a commitment to public service to make the world a better place. I know that we're all looking forward to learning more about the addiction trajectory in the brain and in behavior, an approach to treatment and prevention based on this new understanding of addiction, and quite possibly social change to make the world a healthier place. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Nora Volkov to the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good morning, and thanks for that very nice introduction. It's a pleasure for me to be here and speak with you. I don't rarely do this, that I stand up, and I usually have slides that show the brain with and without drugs. So it's a very unusual format for me, but I think in many ways it's more challenging. I've been 10 years as director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, which is the agency that is part of the NIH that funds approximately 90% of all of the research that relates to drugs in the world. And why did I take this job? Well, I'm by essence a researcher, and I love science. And throughout my professional career, I'm also a physician, I've basically been very much interested in understanding what happens to the human brain when it loses its capacity to regulate its control over the intake of drugs. What happens to the brain of a person that can no longer stop taking drugs, even though this is going to come at the expense of literally catastrophic consequences? What has gone wrong? So that has been my professional interest as a scientist. But I decided to take this job because I also, as a physician, have been extremely frustrated since I was a medical student by the lack of endorsement of the healthcare system of the importance of substance use disorders as part of diseases that need to be addressed like other medical illnesses. And the opportunity of taking the directorship to me was to be able, and that was my goal, how can I make substance use disorders part of a problem that is addressed by the healthcare system? How do we change the criminal justice system so that it addresses, if you're going to incarcerate individuals that are taking drugs, you provide them with treatment? So that's what actually led me to take this position. From the science perspective, we've done enormous advances in terms of our understanding about the effects of drugs, why are certain drugs addictive and not others not, and also what happens in the brain of people that become addicted. Now, these advances have occurred, I would sort of say, dramatically over the past 10 years, and we probably have learned more over the past 10 years than I would say over the past 100 years. And this has to do in part with technologies, and one of the most important technologies in neuroscience in general has been the access of imaging tools that allow us to actually investigate the living human brain. And this is actually, we may give it for granted now, but if you think about it, 15, 20 years ago, the way that we would understand about the brain was what functions of the brain were working was when you have a patient that had a stroke, and then that patient could not move an arm, and then if they die and you could see what areas were damaged, you could associate that area with a particular function. Or with animal studies where you lesion certain areas of the brain and you observe what happened to the behavior of the animal. So the ability of being able to directly probe the living human brain was actually one of the most transformative technologies that has happened in the past century. Now, I was a medical student in Mexico. I was born in Mexico. And I was reading Scientific American, and I came across, and it was in 1980, so it's 30 years. And I read the first article on positron emission tomography, where you actually was telling you could look inside how the brain works in non-invasively. So I got so excited that immediately I convinced my father to fly me to New York University, where they were doing these studies. I show up. Look at basically my way of presenting that. And I said, okay, I want to volunteer. And they took me in, and I volunteered, and then I ended finishing my training over at New York University. And immediately I was fascinated by the opportunity of using positron emission tomography to understand changes in the human brain of people that were addicted. Now, where do you start? Now, what we have known from a lot of work that has happened in animal experiments is that all of the drugs of abuse, whether they are legal or illegal, biology does not make that distinction. They all have a common pharmacological effect in the brain. All of these drugs, they actually increase the concentration of a chemical, dopamine, in limbic areas of the brain. And it is believed that the ability of drugs to increase dopamine in these limbic areas of the brain, particularly in reward centers, is crucial for their rewarding effects and for their potential for producing addiction. Now, why is that so? And again, it's one of those aspects that relates a little bit to the randomness of nature, that certain chemical structures, the few drugs that are addictive, because there are not many chemical compounds that can produce addiction. If you think about all of the chemical compounds out there in the world, there are very few that are addictive. But we have gravitated towards them. So why have we gravitated towards them? Is this something that's uniquely human? Well, no, it's not uniquely human. Actually, any animal will gravitate towards these drugs. And why is that so? It is so because our brain is hardwired to respond to pleasure. And this is a very intelligent design by which nature ensures that it will make us do behaviors that are indispensable for survival. And that is survival of the individual and survival of the species. So for nature to ensure that we will go through the behaviors necessary in order to procure the food that is necessary for us to survive, it has linked to pleasure, to reward. Similarly, as it relates to reproduction, that behavior is associated with reward to ensure that the species will procreate. And so this very, very primitive system of reward, which actually can be identified in flies, is the one that is directly tapped by drugs of abuse. And when you start thinking about it, you start to then recognize why drugs of abuse can produce such a level of havoc in someone's brain, because they can directly, literally, hijack that system that evolved over thousands and thousands of years to ensure survival of the species. And this one of the chemicals, the most important chemical that we know of right now in terms of the activation of this system is dopamine. Now, initially, we were thinking and equating in a very simplistic way the ability of increasing dopamine as a sensation of pleasure itself. But we've come to realize that actually nature is much more clever and intelligent than that. Dopamine is activated in your brain initially when you actually consume something that you didn't know and is pleasurable, or you get exposed to something that is pleasurable. But what it does by producing this very strong signal is basically create a memory that will associate that event, not just with the act of consuming it, but what happened surrounding it. And that memory will follow you. Now, why would this be important? Well, let's imagine that any one of us, at the beginning of civilization, there was no civilization, were over there in the jungle, I'm starving, I see a banana, I climb the tree, I take the banana, I eat it. Highly rewarding, dopamine goes up. Next morning, I'm walking in the forest, and I actually see the yellow color of the banana. And immediately, my brain has learned that that signal predicts reward. And dopamine goes up before I actually eat the banana. But when the dopamine goes up in prediction of the reward, that motivates my behavior to climb the tree and get it. And if you think about it, so it's not just the pleasure itself, but linking a stimulus that's pleasurable with prediction of pleasure to motivate my behavior. So dopamine is motivating my behavior to take actually that particular reinforcer. And this is exactly what drugs are doing. Drugs are increasing dopamine and initially producing pleasure. But as you take it and you get these memories, which we call conditioning, within that drug, what that drug will do is actually motivate our behavior to consume it. I mean, it sounds a little bit bizarre. It motivates our behavior to consume it. And actually, if you ask people that are addicted to drugs, which I always ask them because I'm very, very interested, why do you take the drug? And many of them tell me, you know, Doc, I don't even know why I do it. That drug is no longer pleasurable. I just cannot stop it. That intense drive and motivation to take the drug is at the essence of what drug addiction is, as opposed to what we believe for many years to be, that the person that's addicted is basically taking the drug because of the pleasure that the drug is producing. We've come to realize that that is not the case. In fact, what imaging studies have shown you and it's shown us, and this is actually something that has been replicated in animals and humans to the dismay of the whole scientific community, was that people that are addicted to drugs, when they take the drug, they liberate, actually, when they are consuming it itself, they liberate less dopamine than a person that's not addicted. In turn, they liberate a lot of dopamine when they get exposed to stimuli associated with the drug. So what's happening is when they get these stimuli associated with the drug, dopamine goes up, and that motivates their behavior to take the drug. Even though the drug itself has become much less potent as a chemical agent itself, it's the associated memory and learning that is taking over. Now, in studying this process about why drugs can actually generate these pathological behaviors, because they are activating the dopamine system, but they actually do it so in such a way that it's much more potent and long-lasting, the effects are longer-lasting than natural rewards, and you can call it food or sex. And because of these very powerful and potent effect of drugs in activating the dopamine system, they trigger neuroplastic changes that result in adaptations in the brain that ultimately, on the one hand, make it more sensitive to stimuli associated with the drug, but it comes at the price of making it much less sensitive for natural rewards. And of course, this is extremely challenging when you are trying to address and treat a person that's addicted to drugs. Because in a person that's addicted to drugs, the main motivation for everyday activities is the drug itself. And natural reinforcers don't have the capacity to excite them or stimulate them. So one of the big challenges that therapists have to do is how do you provide that person that's addicted to drugs with alternative rewards that can motivate his or her behavior. You know, for many, many years, us as society, the general lay public, as well as the healthcare system, used to dismiss the problem of drug addiction as a problem of moral failure or poor, basically, self-control, without realizing that to start with, self-control is not something that occurs automatically. In fact, our ability to exert free will is possible because there are certain areas in our brain that allow us to analyze a situation and based on that analysis make a decision that we're going to go for it or not go for it. But we also have areas in our brain that will allow us to sustain our decision and achieve it. And what has happened in drug addiction is indeed the ability to make a decision and to make an assessment is distorted on the one hand, and on the other one, the ability to carry through the areas of the brain that are indispensable for carrying it through are also affected by drugs. And through imaging, researchers have started to identify the landscape of addiction. How has the brain changed? And what we found is that the brain has changed not just in these limbic areas of the brain involved with regard and pleasure, but it has also changed in the areas of the brain that are involved with self-control, the frontal cortex. The frontal cortex is the area of our brain that allows us to control our emotions and our desires. So if I want very much, for example, to drink a glass of wine, but I know that I have to give a presentation tonight, I make the decision that it's not a very good idea for me to drink a wine and be intoxicated when I'm trying to present a dialogue about what are the problems of drug addiction, including alcoholism. So my brain makes the analysis and says, no, Nora, it's not a good idea. And I inhibit my desire to drink the glass of wine, and I have no problem whatsoever. My frontal cortex is functioning properly, so I can sustain that it inhibits the limbic brain, and I don't do it. But in people that are addicted to drugs, the repeated exposure to drugs actually undermines the function of the frontal cortex in such a way that it interferes directly with the ability of an individual's capacity to exert self-control and exert inhibitory actions over things that he or she wants to do. And this is one of the reasons why drug addiction is associated very, very frequently with impulsive behaviors and actions that are actually difficult to explain themselves to the person that's addicted to drugs. You know, in my interactions with people that are addicted to drugs, I have been many instances. I remember one patient that had been in a rehabilitation program for many, many months, and he says, "Doctor, this is it. I'm not going to take drugs. I've realized how I ruined my life. They are not worth it." And then the patient steps out of the hospital release, and they bring him back 1 week later, and he had relapsed. So I ask him, well, what happened? And he says, you know, doc, I do not know what happened when I realized the drug was already in my mouth. So there was the sense that he had actually not even been conscious of the process by which he had fallen into taking the drug, almost like an automatic behavior. And indeed, if you remove the frontal cortex from our actions, what you engender is an automatic behavior. And in the process of drug addiction, the changes in the brain, actually, by removing the ability of the frontal cortex to exert control, leads to the facilitation of these automatic behaviors. Now, as we understand this, one of the very important research questions that has gone along, and I always get asked this question, is if drugs are addicted and they produce these adaptation neuroplastic changes in the reward centers of the brain and in the frontal cortex, how is it that some people take drugs and never become addicted and others do? Very important question. And what do we know about it? Well, we know many things about it. We know, for example, that genetics are very important. There are families who have, where there is a history in many of the members of alcoholism or cocaine addiction or multiple substances. So we know that genetics play a very important role in the vulnerability to addiction. And what we're doing with research is try to understand, well, how do genetics influence whether someone becomes addicted or not? Through what mechanisms? Another aspect that determines our vulnerability to addiction is the age at which we get exposed to drugs. And we know, for example, from studies in alcohol, in marijuana, in tobacco, that the earlier the exposure to these drugs, the greater the likelihood that you become addicted to them. And this, of course, this type of knowledge becomes very, very relevant when you have policy changes that address availability and access of drugs that, while not in principle available to children, make them much more easier to get. And to the extent that you have an adolescent that starts, for example, drinking alcohol when they are 13 or 14, or smoking marijuana before they are age 17, you actually are much more likely on that individual to end up having with a problem of addiction. And finally, there's a third factor that also increases the vulnerability of addiction, and that as it relates to the individual, and that has to do with mental illness. We've come to realize that individuals with mental disorders have high levels of comorbidity with drugs of abuse. What underlines that comorbidity? There are multiple paths that can get you there. One of them is very likely that since many of the mental illness start to emerge during adolescence, at a period where it may be very difficult to make a diagnosis, these kids, in an attempt to automedicate, may start to expose themselves to drug at an age that they are more vulnerable, that then increases their likelihood of becoming addicted. It is also possible that there are common genetic factors that increase your vulnerability for certain mental illness and for addiction. And it is also likely that factors in the environment that increase your risk for mental illness also increase your risk for substance use disorders. And of the factors in the environment, I would say that the most prominent of them all, in terms of increasing vulnerability for addiction, as well as vulnerability for mental illness, are social stressors. And particularly social stressors during childhood and during adolescence will dramatically increase the vulnerability of an individual to end up with a substance use disorders. And, of course, social stressors can also increase the vulnerability to end up with an affective disorder or other mental illnesses. So the knowledge that comes from this, of course, is if adolescence is a period of greater vulnerability for addiction, but it's also the period of greater risk for drug experimentation. How do we as a nation take that knowledge in order to do interventions for doing prevention of substance use disorders among children and adolescents? And this is, again, something that is very, very important, because as we look as our position as a nation, one of the rankings that we don't do very well is with respect to the use of drugs among adolescents. Unfortunately, the United States has one of the highest rates of drug use in the world. And this, in turn, costs us dearly. It costs us not just in terms of economics, which are very, very high, but in my brain, much more importantly, in terms of the cost of an individual's life, which can be basically destroyed by the use of drugs, which is initiated very early on. So one of the priorities vis-a-vis what we promote as research and the Institute is interventions to prevent substance use disorders among adolescents and young adults. How do you prevent? Well, how do you prevent? We've been very successful, you know, in preventing smoking. We've decreased smoking in young people 50% over a period of 15 years. Think about it, 50%. As a result of that very successful intervention in decreasing smoking among adolescents, where now for the past 3 years have more adolescents that smoke marijuana regularly than cigarettes. Think about it, ever in the history of the United States. And this reflects, on the one hand, of course, aggressive campaign to prevent smoking behaviors at the same time that we're seeing increases in smoking of marijuana throughout the country. So prevention does work. Is it sufficient right now in terms of cigarettes? No. We've done tremendous advances, but still approximately 19% of adolescents are regular smokers, 70 to 18 years of age. So we really can improve it much more. But we can take that knowledge that we've gained on how we have succeeded with cigarette smoking for the prevention of other substance use disorders. Now, what about the other intervention that we need to do in substance use? And I said that's one of the reasons why I took this position, that of the treatment of substance use disorders. If you cannot prevent them, then you should treat them. And what we now know is that substance use disorders can be treated. And I remember when I first came to NIDA director, I was actually shocked by the fact that many insurances will not cover for the treatment of substance use disorders. So I said, well, how can they get away for not paying for the treatment of a patient that has a substance use disorder? And they said to me, my staff said to me, which is actually, because their response is treatment does not work. And indeed, this is a belief that is very expanded, that treatment for substance use disorder does not work, because if you take someone and you bring them through a treatment program, 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, the treatment program is terminated and the patient relapses. And that is used to justify that treatment does not work. However, if you take that same argument for another medical illness with chronic characteristics like addiction, that changes in the brain produced by drugs are long-lasting and persist months or years after you stop taking the drug. So if you take another disease, asthma, you take another disease, chronic disease, hypertension, you give the medication to your patient, blood pressure goes down, then you interrupt the medication and the patient relapses. And you use that argument to say, you see, your antihypertensive medication work. You were very well when you were taking it, and now your blood pressure goes up when you are not. Well, in drug addiction, we had distorted that logic to say, yes, you are not taking drugs when you are treatment, but when I stop, you're back into taking drugs, and that is an example that that treatment does not work for drug addiction. So this distorted thinking has actually interfered with the ability to expand the coverage for the treatment of substance use disorders among those individuals that are addicted. With healthcare reform, fortunately, many of the individuals that were addicted to drugs will now have access to insurance. So one of the challenges is going to be to involve the healthcare system for the screening and proper treatment of these addictive disorders, such that the addictive disease itself can be treated, but very importantly, by treating the addicted disorder, the other medical illness that brings the patient to the doctor will actually lead to much better outcomes. We're investing, I wish I could say that we have many medications for the treatment of drug addiction. We have some. We have medications for the treatment of nicotine addiction, alcoholism, and heroin. We have no medications for the treatment of methamphetamine addiction, marijuana, and cocaine. But we have a lot of research. That's one of the areas where we've incentivize researchers and pharmaceutical companies to develop medications that can help overcome the changes in the brain that are produced by drugs. Is it going to be a medicine that's going to be the panacea? No, it's not going to be a medicine that's going to completely solve the problem, because drugs disrupt multiple aspects of an individual's life. What the medication may be able to do is improve the ability and the chances of the person to stay away from taking drugs, while at the same time, interventions, behavioral, social, will help them readjust themselves back into society. I want to end just by just giving you an example of the power of science in terms of where we're going in the development of medications for drug addiction. One of the most exciting areas of research right now, for example, is the development of vaccines that can be used against nicotine, cocaine, or methamphetamine, or heroin. And the technology behind this vaccine development is not different from the technology of vaccines that you may be developed against a virus or a bacteria. You actually inject the subject with an antigenic substance, in this case, an antigenic substance linked with the drug, nicotine or heroin or methamphetamine, to allow for his body to produce or her body antibodies that will then, when the person takes the drug, capture the drug and not let it get inside the brain, and by so doing, interfering with any action of the drug in the brain. Do these vaccines work? They work wonders in animals. In humans, they work in those humans in whom the vaccine can produce sufficient antibodies. The big challenge that we currently have in the technology of vaccine development is that these vaccines are not sufficiently antigenic. So we only have a small percentage of individuals that mount an antibody response that's high enough to be effective. But many, many strategies are being developed, which are taking advantage of the big developments that have gone on, for example, in the development of vaccines for HIV that are being applied for these drug vaccines. If we are to be successful, and this is why the whole notion of science in terms of how powerful it is in solving problems, is if we are to be successful and we can get vaccines that are not just antigenic but actually have no untoward behavior, we could have a tool in our hands that in principle would be very effective in treating substance use disorders, but could also potentially could be used for the prevention of substance use disorders. And that possibility, if just imagine the possibility of having a world with no substance use disorders, with no children or adolescents whose life is deranged by the use of drugs, with no individuals who are wasting their life on because of this motivation for taking a drug and for which they no longer are able to control. And so that is where the power of science is, and that's where I would look into the future, into solving a problem that we have had actually since the beginning of our civilization. Thanks very much for your attention.
Our thanks to Dr. Nora Volkov, Director of the National Institute of Drug Abuse at the National Institutes of Health, for her comments today. It's time now for our audience question period. And Dr. Volkov, we have a number of questions. We are not going to be able to get through all these questions today. You've stimulated an awful lot of interest, and so there are many. And I've tried to cluster them in different areas, and I'm going to start with some more general and then get a little more specific, and then get mildly personal. But not, okay. So some of the more broader ones had to do with, in what ways is the U.S. war on drugs helping or hindering efforts to curtail addiction? Would relate to what you think about some of the causes, and if you were to design a way of thinking better about how we can curtail addiction in this country, what ideas would you have?
Well, I think that one of the issues we've learned is that one of the environmental factors that determines the rate at which people get exposed to drugs is the availability of the drug. So the easier the access of the drug, the greater the likelihood that people will take it, and the greater the number of problems that you will encounter. And people get very surprised when I tell them, you know, the main problems in terms of mortality from drugs are not from the illegal drugs. They are from the legal ones, nicotine and alcohol. And it's not that they are more toxic, not at all. Methamphetamine is much more toxic than something like nicotine. Nor are they more addictive. Methamphetamine is much more addictive than nicotine. There's no comparison. The reason why you have much more mortality associated and morbidity with illegal drugs is because they are legal, and therefore they are widely available, and therefore much more people get exposed to them. So to the extent that there are interventions, and I guess that the drug war, one of its investments is to try to interfere with the entrance of drugs, you could say that is something that in some way is necessary. How do you protect a society from access to drugs? And that is an important one. Now, at the same time, we have to recognize that the measures have not been successful in actually interfering with the entrance of drugs into our country, and we have a very large market of a wide variety of drugs that are available to people of all ages. And thus, from that perspective, my view is I think it is very important to educate, and to educate in a way that is objective and not one that is driven by fear. I think that we've erred in the past very much to put drugs as these really chemicals that if you take them once, they are going to fry your brain. If you remember, there was at one point an advertisement of a fried egg. Well, that has nothing to do with reality. The point is that many people take drugs and they never see any adverse effect on their brain. So it's an issue of, first of all, probability. There's differences between people on how sensitive they are to the toxic effects of drugs on the one hand. And the other one is one of degree. Drugs harm you, and unless you are extraordinarily sensitive, it requires repeated administration of the drug to start to see the ill effect. So it's something insidious. And as a result of that, it's much people can self-deceive themselves on the fact that they are taking the drug and they don't see any ill effect. And thus, providing information in a way that is objective for each, actually, and again, you have to target different for adolescents than to adults, can be very effective. Look at what we've done in this country with cigarette smoking. It's incredible. I was just sort of saying in the young people, we brought the prevalence rates of smoking 50% in 15 years. Why? Because we've educated the community in a way that it makes them also realize that cigarette smoking is something that has very adverse effects with no positive consequences. So it's not automatic because, of course, there are many interests behind it. And we as a society have to take the stance of this is something that we need to invest into. It's way too important. We cannot afford our young people to get exposed to more drugs than they are already exposed. You know, it just came out, I think, the past week, a report on the Institute of Medicine that made a big impact in my brain. You may have seen it or not. It made it into the newspapers. Because it shows that the longevity of the Americans actually is less than that of that you see in 16 countries of equivalent economic of the first world countries. So our longevity is the lowest. And that is not just in terms of adults. You start to see worse outcomes in children, in adolescents, and in young adults. And drugs are one of the culprits. Drugs, by increasing the likelihood of getting people into accidents, drugs because of their adverse medical consequences, and drugs because of the criminal behavior that they garner, are actually driving it. So coming back to your point, I sort of say, I believe in science, I believe in knowledge, I believe that actually we owe the public, we have the obligation of providing that knowledge in a way that is objective, without exaggerations, such that they can use it in ways that when they are making a decision.
Thanks. Here's a kind of a cluster of questions. People were struggling, I think, with trying to make sure they got it right and thinking about the mechanism of how this worked. Is there an underlying limbic motivational drive and then a frontal kind of grasping onto things? But then there were several questions that said, can you restore the functioning of the frontal cortex from someone who's been an addict? Could that addict's frontal lobe ever fully recover?
Well, you know, if you had asked me this question, I would sort of say 10 years ago, I would have said, no, you cannot. The human brain, the adult brain, all of the neurons that we have are there. We have no more new neurons. But what we found over the past 10 years is that the brain is very neuroplastic, even in adulthood. And what that means is that you can have significant recovery. And I guess that a perfect example is the research that has come out with patients with stroke, that by doing very aggressive therapeutic interventions, patients with stroke can recover a lot of their function. And they do that not necessarily by recovering that tissue that is dead, because it's dead, but by actually taking over other areas of the brain to perform that task. So because of what we know from other diseases, I would put forth the concept that you could definitively strengthen the function of the frontal cortex in a person that is addicted through therapeutic interventions. And in fact, that's one of the things that we're asking researchers to look at. How do you strengthen the function of our frontal cortex? What is it that you can do to actually strengthen it? And it's in a simplistic way, but people use that metaphor because it does give us an insight on how it may work. Is like when you have a muscle and you exercise it, it can strengthen itself. When you perform and repeat a certain process in the brain, you can improve the performance. And that improvement in performance is associated with strengthening of synaptic connections. So that area of the brain becomes more effective. Because of that, I would say that yes, you can strengthen the function of the frontal cortex. But again, the issue is going to be determined how much can you recover. It will be dependent. Some people recover more than others. How long have you been taking the drug? How old are you? The older you are, the harder it is for having these neuroplastic changes. At the same time, too, advances in medicine are actually probably going to be allowing us in the future to develop medications that can facilitate that recovery, that can facilitate neuroplastic changes.
So some people ask about that in terms of what kinds of things might help. There were questions about amino acids, some questions about things that can naturally increase dopamine, some idea of even using oxytocin or other things in its dopaminergic effect. And there were several others. So in addition to brain exercises, are there any things that you might think of that nutritionally or medication-wise that you think?
You know, I wish I could give you a list and tell you, yes, you eat this A, B, C, yeah. D, and don't eat the other, because it's actually... But I don't know. Researchers have tried to do. Are there certain amino acids that will increase release of dopamine in the brain? And these studies are done in animals. And overall, it has not been very clear that there are any specific nutrients that can increase dopamine function. But what we do know that seems to be associated in animals, again, with improved performance of dopamine systems is physical activity. So that the notion, moreover, what we are knowing, and there's a lot of interest I would sort of say over the past 5 years, more and more researchers are getting into it because it's fascinating to try to understand what are the effects of physical activity in the brain. And, for example, one of the findings that has been replicated is physical activity increases the concentration of the brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which is a neurotrophic factor that promotes synaptic formation, that promotes vessels for forming. So it is now understood that physical activity is not just good for your muscles, but actually it is good for the well-being of your brain. And in animal studies, it appears to be, again, there is some evidence that it may sustain dopaminergic function as we grow older, which is normally as we grow older, dopamine function goes down. Well, if you have if you are physically active, that decline is much less so. Another thing that may be helpful, and this is another fascinating area of research, which is the intersection between obesity and the reward system, and to what extent food and the changes that occur in our body when we become obese interfere with the function of the dopamine system. And indeed they do, because many of these signaling molecules like insulin or leptin, which regulate our hunger signal and satieties, directly regulate the activity of the dopamine cells. So the sense is, and in animal models and in humans, that obesity is associated with an impaired function of dopaminergic systems. So sustaining oneself as a lean, physical activity are actually good behaviors to try to keep a dopamine system functioning properly. But I don't have any nutrition. I would sort of say chocolate for my brain is going to activate my dopamine system. But I don't know if in the long run, but certainly will activate it.
So I've heard that you jog 7 miles a day. I wonder if that's why you're so smart.
I run 7 miles a day because I love it. It's extremely rewarding in my brain, which is, again, the whole issue of the sense about how do you teach someone to enjoy the pleasures that our brain gives us? Physical activity is extraordinarily pleasurable. Just look at if you have dogs and you take them to the park, they go crazy running like crazy. Look at children. You go into the park and just the physical activities is joyful, is pleasurable. And as we grow older, we lose that sense. And in a part, we just basically stop realizing how pleasurable it is to do physical activity. So my brain has not forgotten that running is very pleasurable, and I do it.
So some of the questions, I had a couple questions about sugar, and you've already alluded to that with chocolate a little bit. But people wonder, what about sugar addiction, or what about the way that sugar might create a similar process and then lead to poor health?
Yeah, no, I've been very intrigued. When I was actually before I came to NIDA, this was close to 20 years ago, I was asking my predecessor, who was the director of NIDA, and I said, his name was Alan Leshner. I said, Alan, would NIDA fund a study? I'm very intrigued by the similarities between the compulsive pattern of drug intake and the inability to control and the compulsive food intake that you see in individuals that suffer from morbid obesity. And I'm interested on comparing them because I want to see if they have the similar phenomenology, the same changes in the brain. And he said to me, Nora, yes, if you can get the study section to fund it. Unfortunately, the study sections did not fund it because the study sections, and there's been this has created a lot of controversy. The whole field that obesity, that there's not addiction to food. Now, the reality is food can be highly rewarding. And we have, in our society, we have become magicians as creating extremely, extremely appealing food. And I find myself having to constantly inhibit the desire to eat it. Because on top of that, it's everywhere. So we've generated and modified our environment in ways that this highly rewarding food and actually food that has high content in sugar and high content in fat in animals, again, it's not just humans that suffer these conditions, in animals will lead to compulsive administration of huge quantities of calories. So you can generate these aberrant behaviors that in a human can result in obesity because you have access to the food. In animals, you don't have access to the food because they cannot go to the supermarkets that are everywhere and surrounded by all of this food, plus obesogenic food are very, very cheap, so you can get it. So this, slowly the field has started to come to recognize that indeed the reward system gets disrupted in people that start to overeat, in part secondary, curiously, to the changes that are associated with the metabolic syndrome. So for all you that don't know what the metabolic syndrome is when people start to become obese, one of the first things that happen is you become insulin resistant. You also become leptin resistant. And the insulin resistance leads to diabetes. And so you start to have high levels of circulating insulin, but the cells are not responding to it. And the same thing with leptin. And leptin normally basically decreases your desire to eat. But if you become resistant to it, that does not work. And those signals are then modifying the reactivity of the dopamine cells in such a way that they become extremely sensitive to food reinforcers. They are much more sensitive to food reinforcers than when you don't have the metabolic syndrome. So this has led more and more to recognize that there is an area of overlap between these conditions, the compulsive pattern of administration that occurs with drugs in addiction, and the compulsive pattern of food intake that you see in some of these cases of morbid obesity. There's also some data to suggest, actually, and this was work done by this investigator, Hobel. When I read the paper, it was an old paper, 20 years ago, and I said, wow. He did a very interesting study. He, in animals, you give opioids, you give heroin, you give them, and then you give an antagonist, and what you see is the little animal, boom, jumps. And that is a withdrawal. So you can actually measure how much it jumps and how long it takes to jump, and that gives you an idea of the withdrawal from the opioids. Well, this investigator, Hubble, instead of giving the animals heroin, he gave them sugar, high content of sugar, and then gives them the antagonist. And just the same antagonist that he gave the animals that they gave heroin, and the animals jump. So he produced a withdrawal, an opioid withdrawal with sugar, indicating that when you are taking sugar, because I just spoke of dopamine, but there are other chemicals in the brain that are involved with pleasure. One of them are endogenous opioids. And sugar evidently is releasing endogenous opioids, which are very pleasurable and rewarding. And through that mechanism, through the consumption of high levels of sugar, you may be producing high release of endogenous opioids that may lead to a similar level of dependence, of course, albeit at a less lower level than when you're taking these drugs. But this is the type of findings that are bringing these two fields together.
So let me remind us all that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest, Dr. Nora Volkov, director of the National Institute of Drug Abuse at the National Institute of Health, who's discussing her work aimed at treating and eventually finding a way to stop all forms of addiction. A cluster of questions had to do with treatment of addictions, wondering whether you use similar things or whether each different kind of addiction needs a separate pathway in terms of ways that you might more target treatments. Are there similarities and are there differences?
They are both. And it's always great when you can say, yes, this and that.
Yes.
As opposed to sort of says, no, this or the other. No. What happens is that there are common elements to the process of drug addiction. So it's not surprising, for example, that one of the interventions that it's helpful for people to stop taking drugs are group therapy like Alcoholic Anonymous or Cocaine Anonymous or, I guess, Food Anonymous. They are actually effective. They help people stop overeating. They help people stop smoking. They help people stop drinking. They help people stop taking heroin. Now, what are you doing in a group environment? One of the things that you are doing, and I actually is, when you are an addicted to a drug, I told you one of the prices that you pay, that your brain pay, is that it's much less sensitive to rewards and reinforcers. And as part of everyday life and the life of an addicted person, particularly if you are dealing with illicit substances, you become more and more and more isolated, and you have less and less reinforcers. For us human creatures, one of the most powerful reinforcers motivating our behaviors are social interactions. Look at what we are doing right now. What we're having is a social exchange. So when you're a person that's addicted, even that reinforcer is actually taken away from you, or you take yourself away from it because of the drug. So by going into one of these group therapies, you are immediately providing an alternative reinforcer to the individual that's not going to be judgmental. And that process itself anchors them into having an alternative behavior that motivates their actions. So you're giving them a motivator. So and that process is common across all of the drugs of abuse. Now, with respect to specifics, I mentioned we have treatments for nicotine addiction. For example, nicotine replacement therapy can help individuals stop taking smoking. Bupropion, an antidepressant, is also effective in helping people stop smoking. Chantix, an anti-smoking medication, is actually, as of now, the most effective medication we currently have to stop smoking. These medications we are not going to be giving to treat someone that has cocaine addiction. On the other hand, someone that has heroin, you can give them a medication like buprenorphine, methadone, Vivitrol, and these are specific medications to help them not take the drug. They basically act to a certain extent, they act on the same targets as the drug, nicotine in the nicotine receptors, buprenorphine in the opioid receptors, but with different properties. And this is what a lot of people don't understand and says you're giving one drug for the other, because you're going for a drug that acts on the nicotine receptors, that acts on the opioid receptors. Yes, they act on the same receptor, but they do it very differently in terms of its potency, number one, but very important, its dynamics. Because when you are taking a drug, for it to be very rewarding, it has to go very, very fast into the brain. And these medications that we use to treat people that are addicted to nicotine or people that are addicted to heroin go into the brain much more slowly and stabilize those receptors. And this provides you a safe way to treat them. So this is an example about two. One, a common characteristic that, as an intervention for multiple substances, and then the specific ones that relate to the particular chemical substance you're taking.
So now for the mildly personal question. I think everybody in the audience who read something about your background saw that and read that your great-grandfather was Leon Trotsky, who was certainly a courageous man that had strong beliefs. And I think one of the psychiatrists in the audience sent in this question asking if there, what impact do you think that your family's struggles, the loss that your family's endured, but the courage and the other things might have had on your own tenacity in medicine and the direction that you have chosen to go and the way that you've decided to do things? I don't think they're asking for your whole psychoanalysis, but just thoughts about the heritage that you have.
And I've never been in psychoanalysis, I confess.
Okay. That probably accounts for your straightforward courage then.
Yeah. No. But I grew up in the house where my great-grandfather was killed. And I history was part of my upbringing when I was a child and an adolescent. And what was very clear in my brain was the sense that you're given a certain talent, whatever it is, and you have an obligation to use it in a way that it will help others. I think that's exactly where it basically affected me. I was imprinted, with the sense that each one of us has a responsibility with our lives to improve in any way that we can the life of others.
Good. Yeah. That was good. That's, so I'll go back to addiction then. That just stopped me. Thinking about there were a number of questions saying, do you think people need to hit rock bottom? Do people need to be incarcerated? What's the point that people finally think about getting help?
What's the down elevator,
and when do people get off?
No. You don't need to hit bottom, because many times that bottom feels you jump out of the window to kill yourself. I think that we develop these phrases, you need to hit bottom. I mean, I think that we have to break the dogma. The reality is a medical illness. You are not going to let the person go to the doctor when the cancer has disseminated all over the place. You actually want to intervene as soon as you can. We developed that dogma of you have to hit bottom, I guess out of frustration, by the sense that one of the things that happen in drug addiction is a disease of the brain. It basically interferes with the function of areas of the brain that, among other things, allow you to be aware of pathology. So, like, we get all of these things for granted, but everything that we perceive is the function of the brain. So, for example, if you're hungry, it's not for granted. There's an area of the brain, the insula, that actually perceives hunger. If you have pain, there's an area on the brain, the insula and the anterior cingulate gyrus, allow you to perceive pain. If you are sick, there are areas of the brain, including that insula and the anterior cingulate gyrus, that actually can identify where something is not functioning properly. Those areas are basically affected by drugs. So at the essence of the pathology in drug addiction is a disruption of the brain areas that you need in order to be aware that there's something fundamentally wrong with the way that your brain is working. So what we call self-deception is not, again, coming out of the clouds. It's the function of a brain that is not working properly. We all, to a greater or less extent, use self-deception. But there are points where the reality is so strong that we can no longer use self-deception unless our brain is not working properly. So that is part of the problem, that it was, as a physician, our therapists get very frustrated because patients will not admit that they have a problem because they don't recognize it. Literally, their brain is unable to do it. And thus, they cannot engage them. They cannot motivate them into treatment. And that's why, to me, a very important aspect of what I like to do as a director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse is to really change the involvement, to increase the involvement of the healthcare system, because physicians are in very unique positions to identify very early on a substance use disorder before it actually escalates. And even if it has escalated, physicians are in a very good position to do an intervention that can actually interfere from going up before that person hits bottom. And if the person hits bottom, again, the healthcare system should intervene. And if you are going, and again, I bring this because I've come to realize in my life that my weapon is science. I use science. I think knowledge. Knowledge is what we place. And then others that are doing policy take that knowledge and make decisions. So I'm not bringing forward when you are incarcerating someone for drugs. What I say, if you're going to incarcerate someone for drugs, you better treat them. Because if you do not treat them, that person is going to relapse. And it's also, if you don't treat them, likely that when they leave treatment, they're actually going to be in worse shape than they when enter it, if you do not treat them. So that's where I would put the importance of, I would not wait until they hit bottom, not at all. I would treat as early as you can recognize.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we have time for only one last question. And there was one question that asked about, do you need any subjects or volunteers for your studies? Anything we can do to accelerate the action of your research, additional funding? But there was another related one that said, where do you see your research going? And I know you got 2 minutes to do this, but where do you see research going in your own research or the research of NIDA?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of work that is needed in terms of actually advances in the field of drug addiction. One of the areas to me that will be the most important is we need to develop better medications. And then people criticize me and says, you are trying to over-medicalize addiction, and medicine will not be the solution, and it's not going to be the panacea, but it's going to help. But if, you know, one of the things that has happened is that one of the things that has interfered with the treatment of substance use disorder has been the stigma of addiction. And the way that you destigmatize a disorder is by identifying the causes. Now, we've done that with drug addiction. We have actually characterized the landscape of abnormalities in the brain of people that are addicted. But what we have not been able to do is to have sufficiently efficient medications that will allow the healthcare system to embrace it. If we had more medications, then it would almost be automatic that the healthcare system would embrace it, and that would decrease the stigma. And that's why I'm so interested in bringing forward the notion of more medicines, while at the same time recognizing that addiction is a complex disorder that will require, in parallel, a multi-pronged approach to reinstitute the individual to the society. With respect to my research, I'm actually extremely interested on dealing with the question that you asked me before. What is it that we can do to help the brain recover from the changes that have happened in the person from exposure to drugs? So I'm interested in terms of interventions that may strengthen the function of the frontal cortex, that may improve the function of the reward system so that the individual can start to respond to everyday stimuli and motivate their behavior. That's where I would like to go.
Our thanks to Dr. Nora Volkov, Director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse at the National Institute of Health. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. My name is Dr. Robert Hendren, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.